Hello and welcome to The War Pod by the Oxford Research Group. My name is Liam Walpole. In this episode, my colleague Megan and I interview David Greeley. David is a third-year PhD candidate at the University of Liverpool. His research project explores the evolution of human rights considerations within the context of British foreign policy from 1977 to 1997. The title of his PhD is Human Rights and British Foreign Policy, 1977 to 1997, an intellectual biography of David Owen. In 2017, David participated in the Global Humanitarianism Research Academy in Mainz and Geneva, and in 2018, he studied at the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C., as a fellow at the John W. Kluge Center. Now, in recent years, the concept of an ethical foreign policy has been repopularized and adopted by political parties like the UK Labour Party. But who is David Owen, and what role did he have as an innovator of a human rights-based foreign policy? Well, here's our interview with David Greeley.
Well, hello, David. Thanks so much for coming in. You've made a trek from the north down to the south. Now, you're currently studying a PhD, as we're saying in our intro, at Liverpool University. Mm-hmm. And you've decided to focus your research on the origins of an ethical consideration in the UK's foreign policy approach. And I think, you know, Megan, you'll probably agree this is quite a relevant area that we've sort of been focusing on, not only because of increased debates within parties, political parties here in the UK. If you look at the Labour Party under Jeremy Corbyn, they're very much supporting a ethical foreign policy. And of course, the issues, I suppose, is where the spotlight has been over the last couple of years around the relationship that the UK has with Saudi Arabia. Now, this is not a new relationship. It's not a new issue, but it's definitely come to the forefront of people's minds in Parliament, among the public, among the media, given the impact in the conflict in Yemen and Britain's role in supporting Saudi Arabia. But what does an ethical foreign policy actually mean? Mm-hmm. And what does it actually aim to do differently?
So yeah. Standing after the big questions.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. It's very much a contested term. I think it'd be accurate to say that all attempts to construct a quote-unquote ethical foreign policy are united in their attempts to arrive at a broader definition of self-interest than a sort of traditionalist or realist conception of foreign policy that only looks at sort of securing the, you know, financial well-being and, mm-hmm. and the security of its citizens. So this kind of broadening of national self-interest in many cases necessitates an engagement with human rights promotion, humanitarian intervention, and sort of global health initiatives, that sort of thing. And it's also, it seems, a kind of at once an inward-looking and outward-looking process, this construction of ethical foreign policy, wherein policymakers seek to identify the sort of values of mm-hmm. Their respective nations and then project that sort of value system onto the global stage. Mm-hmm. And this is something that you kind of clearly see with Robin Cook's attempts to outline an ethical dimension to New Labour's foreign policy in 1997. I think he famously said that the Labour government refuses to accept that we have to check in or leave behind our political values when we check in our passports to travel mm-hmm. on diplomatic duty. And then he went on to sort of try and place human rights concerns at the heart of New Labour's foreign policy, at least rhetorically anyway. So that's I think that's kind of whistle stop tour.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
as you say, really it's a very contested
now term. You mentioned Robin Cook. He is always the individual that people seem to talk about when they reference an ethical foreign policy, and it's definitely been the case in the last couple of years with the Labour Party. They always talk about Robin Cook, but he wasn't actually the innovator of this approach, was he?
No, not exactly. So when I was conducting preliminary research for my PhD project that you mentioned, I was struck by the really striking similarities between the rhetoric used by Robin Cook during his mission statement in 1997, and the rhetoric used by David Owen, who was Foreign Secretary during the Callaghan Labour government from 1977 to 79. You know, Owen also tried to at least rhetorically place human rights at the heart of British foreign policy, argued that policymakers needed to reflect you know, the general populace and its kind of human rights considerations. And so when I sort of delved a bit deeper into this kind of rhetorical similarity, I found that this wasn't, you know, sort of fleeting or sort of solitary reference. Rather, human rights at this stage, during the late 1970s, does become quite a sort of key issue in the foreign policy of the Labour government. So my PhD essentially tries to kind of tie the threads together in a way by sort of exploring this evolution of the relationship between human rights and British foreign policy from the late 1970s through to the kind of, late 90s.
Right. That sounds really fascinating. Can you perhaps tell us more about who David Owen is and maybe more about his background as well, where he came from and why he was interested in this topic?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, David Owen is probably most widely known in the UK for his attempts to reshape like domestic social democratic politics during the 1980s. He was one of the gang of four Labour politicians to split from the party and form the SDP in 1981. But yeah, as I say, he was appointed
deputy leader, wasn't he?
Yeah,
SDP.
Yeah. So he was, but he's actually appointed as Labour Foreign Secretary in February 1977, following the untimely death of Anthony Crossland. But at this stage, he was kind of sort of unknown quantity. He was the youngest Foreign Secretary since Anthony Eden, only 38 years old. And no one really expected this sort of elevation of human rights concerns. And as I say, it was in his first major speech as Foreign Secretary that he tries to sort of or he says that Britain's going to take a stand on human rights issues in every corner of the globe. Why did he sort of focus on human rights? Well, I think there's kind of a confluence of domestic and international issues going on here. So I think in part he saw human rights promotion as a way of kind of reattaching or reconnecting the Labour Party to its the sort of radical spirit in which it was founded. He talked a lot about how, you know, the Labour Party was nothing if not a moral crusade, sort of echoing Harold Wilson. But he also felt that under Wilson, the Labour Party had become increasingly kind of managerial and had ceased to sort of inspire and was, you know, failing to inspire a new generation of voters. So I think in that sense, human rights, it was a way of kind of giving the Labour Party a bit of a shot in the arm, a bit of sort of moral conviction. And in fact, he publishes a book on human rights when he's in office in 1978. And in the first chapter, he very much tries to frame human rights as a natural policy for socialists to champion.
I had enough time to write a book while he was
Yeah,
in
I know,
office.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it? Yeah,
I'm not sure Dominic Raab's got enough time to do that today, is he?
I don't know. But alongside those kind of domestic considerations, there's a lot going on in the 1970s that served to elevate human rights as a legitimate focus for international relations. There's been a huge amount written about how the 1970s was the breakthrough decade for human rights and international relations. So you had, at the same time, Jimmy Carter in the US. He'd made US foreign policy more focused on human rights promotion. You also have a growing grassroots sort of civil society engagement. Amnesty International it receives the Nobel Peace Prize in 1977. The Helsinki process has codified human rights concerns in the context of the East-West dialogue. So all of these things have bumped up human rights to a kind of hitherto unseen level of prominence. It's very much kind of cause célèbre at the time. The confluence of these sort of domestic and international concerns means that human rights is very much there to be grasped at by the time that Owen becomes Foreign Secretary.
It's really interesting because he sounds like he was a very interesting character and had quite a lot to say on this topic. But it seems at the same time that he's kind of fallen into the background when we talk about the history of the ethical foreign policy concept, whereas Robin Cook is often the person who is pointed to. So why do you think that is? Why is there that focus on Cook as opposed to Owen?
Yeah, you're right. I mean, the existing academic literature on the sort of infusion of ethical concerns in British foreign policy does tend to see Robin Cook's mission statement as a kind of radical departure from, I guess, the sort of deeply entrenched realism that predominated hitherto. I think maybe a reason for this contemporary focus is that a lot of this literature has been produced by international relations scholars who have a more contemporary, like, policy-oriented focus.
Right.
But that, I suppose, also begs the question as to why historians haven't engaged with sort of previous iterations of a, you know, quote-unquote ethical foreign policy. Yeah, I could only really speculate, but I think maybe, you know, lingering assumptions that British foreign policy has always kind of been guided predominantly by realpolitik, you know, ideas like perfidious Albion, and it's the idea that human rights champions existed sort of within the British foreign policy kind of machinery probably doesn't sit comfortably alongside those sort of assumptions. So maybe that sort of militated against a substantive engagement prior to Robin Cook. But I think you also maybe have to look at the failure to appropriately institutionalize human rights concerns during the time that I'm looking at. So if we look across to what was going on in the US during the Carter administration, you have the establishment of a separate Bureau of Human Rights and Humanitarian Affairs at the State Department, headed by a new Assistant Secretary of State for Human Rights and Humanitarian Issues. So you have the establishment of a kind of, not independent, but at least a recognisable human rights bureaucracy that would maybe stand the test of time and the comings and goings of administrations whose leaders may or may not be as interested in human rights as Carter was. In the UK, by contrast, even though you get an elevation of human rights concerns within the context of British foreign policy under Owen, human rights responsibilities within the Foreign Office are kind of foisted upon pre-existing departments that have broader remits that aren't specifically or, you know, distinctly concerned with human rights issues. So the UN department, for instance. And I think this kind of makes human rights a bit of a hostage to fortune. If you remove the impetus from above and you have, you know, when, in the coming of a new government, ministers who aren't so much focused on human rights, that human rights focus in those departments is going to diminish. And I think that's something you can see when you get to the 1979 watershed and the coming of the Thatcher government. Human rights concerns in the context of overseas aid, for example, that relationship starts to be downgraded, I think, quite quickly. So, yeah, I'd say, a kind of two-pronged thing, the sort of the scholarly sort of proclivities of certain people, and also the failure of the bureaucratization of human rights, I think, has maybe contributed to that myopic focus that we're struggling with.
Because I mean, it's quite interesting because I mean, David Owen is still alive and he's in the House of Lords, isn't he? But Robin Cook is obviously no longer alive, and it seems. I mean, whether it's because there was quite a dramatic end to his role or time as Foreign Secretary that means that he was seen as a man of principle. And I think you're absolutely right with regards to sort of the contemporary nature. It still seems sort of quite recent history within the Labour Party, but also among the public and the media. So maybe that also has a bearing on it as well. So we've talked about David Owen. We've talked about Robin Cook. And they both seem to sort of appear to have been the lead personalities to have sort of driven this concept, if I can put it that way, and sort of brought it to the fore of the political agenda over the last sort of 40, 50 years. Was there anyone else? I always sort of understood that Clare Short, for example, who was another one of those characters in the Blair government, was sort of aligned to sort of the Robin Cook sort of agenda whilst at DFID. Was she quite influential in this area, do you know?
Yeah, I mean, it kind of goes slightly beyond the sort of scope of my research. But it's speaking to members of human rights NGOs who were active during that period. Certainly Clare Short's name gets thrown around as a particularly influential figure. I certainly don't want to make it appear that David Owen was a kind of lone voice in promoting human rights. Even if you look back to the late 1970s, various members of the Callaghan government were similarly interested and engaged with human rights. For instance, Minister for Overseas Development, Judith Hart, is very influential in elevating human rights within the context of overseas aid. Owen's Minister of State, Frank Judd, likewise approaches.
He's human also still in the household.
And approached human rights as likewise from a distinctly socialist perspective. And yeah, his engagement with human rights has continued through his membership of various human rights committees and as his role as director of Oxfam UK. So Robin Cook as well, his engagement with human rights can be traced back to the 1970s when he sought to place a lot of pressure on the Callaghan government in an attempt to reshape its attitudes about selling arms to, you know, human rights offenders. So yeah, there's certainly... Yes, certainly not a lone voice, and perhaps even, you know, not the most recognisable voice. But yeah. I think by following David Owen's story, you get an interesting look at sort of the evolution of these debates and how they kind of intersected with related ideas about sort of humanitarian intervention. David Owen's an interesting lens through which to view these things, but I'm always constantly trying to contextualise his engagement.
The fact that he was Foreign Secretary as well
has
some bearing on why he's this quite, you know, prominent character in looking at the historiography.
And then maybe going from there, because I think it is really interesting to talk about these personalities who obviously had a very big impact on the way that this was thought, but I'm curious to know more about the practical implications as well of embedding this human rights agenda at the heart of the UK's approach to foreign policy. So what sort of measures do you think were put in place to ensure that human rights were incorporated into political decision-making?
Although I mentioned that David Owen kind of amplified or elevated human rights within the context of British foreign policy from 77 to 79, he certainly didn't introduce the concept. And actually, following the Pinochet coup in Chile in 1973, you start to see human rights begin to factor in more to the British foreign policy-making process. So that connection's already kind of been established, but the decisions taken within the Foreign Office in late 1976 to try and implement or introduce more objective and reliable criteria by which a sort of human rights-based foreign policy can be established. So this idea to kind of create this human rights comparative assessment was happened upon. So posts overseas would grade their respective
When we're talking about nations. Places, we're talking about embassies.
They were instructed to grade their respective countries' human rights performance based on various criteria. And once, you know, these results were collated, you'd essentially have a human rights league table where all these countries were ranked based on this sort of strange and quite arbitrary sort of number system. But anyway, this was supposed to, you know, give ministers the information they needed to construct a, you know, a more consistent, more objective human rights-based foreign policy that would kind of inoculate them from, you know, charges of hypocrisy and double standards and subjectivity. Mm. Well, at least that was the idea anyway.
I think it's quite interesting hearing about what's the full title? The human rights.
Well, yeah, it's Gustav Fiennes. Human rights comparative assessment.
Human rights comparative assessment. Because obviously there's a system in place now, the Overseas Security Justice Assistance Assessment, or the OSJAs. Which basically are there to measure or calculate risk of the UK providing support overseas. And it's been an area that we've been looking at with quite a lot of interest in terms of how the UK is making sure that when it is providing support to military partners, for example, it's putting in place pretty stringent and rigorous processes to make sure that they're not then encouraged, emboldened the states that the UK is sponsoring to then go and target civilians, for example, and also to make sure that the UK's approach isn't just tactical, because there are often many issues in terms of a corrupt security sector. Well, you can't just go and teach them IHL training, because if the whole thing is rotten, then that's just going to be a plaster over, really. Addressing the symptom rather than the cause of some of the problems. I think it's interesting that, and it goes back to everything you've been talking about with regards to, well, you had David Owen and others talking about ethical foreign policy, and then sort of Robin Cook turns up and sort of tries to make it original. Nothing is ever, as far as I understand, original in politics often. At least they try and make it to sound like it's original, but it's not. But I think something that's really clear in sort of today's context is that there's always a challenge and there are always inconsistencies. You're talking there about trying to make sure that there was sort of a consistent approach through this comparative assessment. But, you know, for example, the UK speaks, you know, often quite commendably about human rights issues in countries like Saudi Arabia, Myanmar, Nigeria, but often continues to provide military assistance and support, I think, in particular with regards to Saudi Arabia. I mean, Dominic Raab was only there, I think, last week speaking to, I think, the foreign minister, Saudi foreign minister, about human rights. But this isn't, as I said, it's not a new challenge.
No.
And I think you've suggested that Owen, while foreign secretary, in some of the conversations we've had in the past as well, and talks that I've seen you give, that also found himself sort of struggling to reconcile human rights concerns with the pursuit of Britain's sort of rightful share of, for example, the global weapons industry. But Owen was hardline on El Salvador, as far as I understand it. And I think you can provide a bit of context to that. But then it was less so when it came to, for example, the Shah of Iran, when there was opportunities for trade and weapons exchanges. So what do you think about that?
Absolutely. I mean, so the two case studies you mentioned, El Salvador and Iran, featuring my PhD research, because I think they clearly illuminate the narrow parameters within which human rights was actually able to influence the foreign policy making process, particularly when economic interests were at stake. So yeah, in terms of El Salvador, Owen, in October 1977, finds out that El Salvador, you know, the kind of right-wing dictatorship there, is about to take delivery of around, I think, £850,000 worth of British armoured vehicles. And Owen, having made several public statements about, you know, making human rights a central pillar of British foreign policy, is not best pleased. And decides that he's kind of going to draw a line in the sand, and these deals, these contracts have to be cancelled. And he, you know, encounters a lot of sort of official opposition. And I won't sort of detail.
And that's within the Foreign Office.
Yes, and also the other department, the Treasury, and stuff, not best pleased. But I won't sort of detail forensically the kind of comings and goings and the intrigue that led to the eventual cancellation of the deal in early 1978. But it's a fascinating story that involves a prolonged lobbying campaign by the Catholic Institute of International Relations, which used, you know, government leaks and journalist contacts and sympathetic parliamentarians to, you know, put sufficient pressure on the Callaghan government to reverse course and cancel the contracts. At one stage, the Archbishop of Westminster, Cardinal Basil Hume, actually gets involved and sends what turned out to be a decisive letter to Jim Callaghan on the eve of a cabinet subcommittee meeting, where the decision was, you know, eventually taken to cancel the contracts. Although it must be said that human rights concerns in and of themselves, you know, didn't prove sufficient justification to actually cancel the contracts, even though a lot of people made that argument. Those who, argued in favour of cancellation within the Foreign Office tended to focus more on strategic considerations regarding the possibility of these armoured vehicles being used against British troops stationed in Belize, and the sort of ongoing conflict between Guatemala and El Salvador over Belize. And they did this because they didn't want a sort of dangerous precedent being set. As I mentioned, you had the human rights comparative assessment. What would happen if you cancel the El Salvador contracts on human rights grounds, and then you find that you have, you know, pre-existing contracts with countries whose human rights record is even worse? What if these contracts are far more lucrative than the, you know, measly £850,000?
Because it is not a huge amount of money, but
There's a kind of, the comparative assessment essentially, this was the kind of litmus test, and it didn't really prove to be much use. Essentially, it was foreign policy was still, or the decision to kind of lean on human rights concerns was still essentially up to the subjectivity and the on the spot decision making of, you know, key policymakers like Owen. And this becomes even more apparent with regard to Iran, as you mentioned. The decision is taken. As the kind of Iranian revolution is proceeding, to support the Shah, warts and all. even providing him with the crowd control equipment necessary to kind of quash the sort of internal rebellions resulting from decades of autocratic rule there, mm-hmm. So providing him with like CS gas and, you know, police training and whatnot. Yeah, and this is, you know, the documents clearly show that this was, you know, based on an appreciation of economic considerations. Right. The Shah is one of the most loyal patrons of the British weapons industry. Yeah, and it simply wouldn't do to kind of chastise him too harshly on his human rights record, even though I think in his first meeting with the Shah, Owen does bring up, you know, just trying to slightly nudge him in a more, human rights appreciative direction. although Anthony Parsons, who was the British ambassador in Tehran, recalls that this was done in a very low key. I think David Owen, you know, has one kind of carefully worded sentence on human rights and then proceeds to shift the subject of the discussions.
I'm sure it's a less controversial kind of situation when ministers go over to see the Saudis. And,
yeah, I was going to say, it sounds very familiar.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I think they can easily say that they've raised human rights concerns, but what does that mean? I mean, it's sort of asking the question, well, how's it all going then? Oh, it's all fine. Oh, brilliant. Okay, right, next step. Next step. When are we selling you arms? You know? So I think it's an interesting case study. To look at, and I think it really compares quite well to the current context.
I think that's definitely right. And do you think it's also right to say that Robin Cook kind of faced similar challenges post 1997 when he came under pressure to go against his own ethical approach?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think in the case of Robin Cook, that dilemma was highlighted even more strikingly and very early on. So I think just 77 days after he outlines this ethical dimension, he agrees to the sale of Hawk aircraft and crowd control equipment to the repressive regime in Indonesia. I think his biographer recalls that shortly after the news of this broke, you know, protesters started gathering outside his office bearing the banner that had the slogan on it, Ethical Foreign Policy, RIP. it was highlighted very early on. This didn't necessarily spell the end of his attempts to reconcile strategic and human rights imperatives in foreign policy. Mm-hmm. The ethical dimension kind of limps on for a few years, but Labour ministers soon start to realise that this had become a kind of albatross around the neck of the government. And leading up to the general election in 2001, the ethical tag is sort of dropped altogether. That was one of the things that I was struck by when noticing the kind of striking similarities again between the two, and which again, you know, cast a spotlight on this surprising lack of scholarly coverage. These debates weren't new when they were happening in 1997. In fact, just almost exactly 20 years prior, they'd played out with alarming sort of degrees of similarity.
And how much? Just quickly, we've got to press on, but I just wanted to ask you how much, because you talked about David Owen having to get sign-off from Jim Callaghan. It went to a subcommittee when it came to the El Salvador case. How much influence did the foreign secretary have when we talk about Robin Cook? I think you're probably more expertly can cover David Owen on this front, but how much sort of authority did they have to just sort of overrule the Prime Minister would say, or was it very much their decision, or was it the Prime Minister to make?
Yeah, I think in terms of human rights issues, Callaghan, by and large, was happy to let Owen be slightly out in front of the government on lots of issues. But again, it comes back to that point of when, you know, economic interests are, you know, great enough and the elevation of human rights may imperil those, it's very much the case that Owen was kind of reined in. I mean, I don't have the sort of necessary documentation to you know, bear that out in much detail, but certainly in the case of Iran, you know, the decision was taken at a kind of prime ministerial level, and that the Shah would be supported. And warts and all, there was a kind of forensic report commissioned by the Foreign Office shortly after the fall of the Shah, which kind of looked back at governmental policy during those years. And it was kind of decided that the route that, you know, was laid out for Owen was kind of decided. There weren't really many alternatives beyond British support, you know, kind of moderated by the odd hint in the direction of a, you know, human rights. And certainly it was the case that Owen was kind of only allowed to go so far when human rights promotion was concerned.
It's very useful. Now, you've also talked in your research about what Owen has come to describe as the morality of compromise. Mm-hmm. which sort of speaks to some of the issues we've all been talking about. Can you explain what he meant by that?
Yeah, so this is a term that crops up kind of in the context of these ongoing debates at El Salvador and Iran, where he's been foreign secretary for quite a while, and he's now well-versed in the kind of balancing act that has to be struck between ethical and strategic considerations. And it kind of reflects, I think, the philosophy of Isaiah Berlin, who's a figure that Owen cites in his book on human rights as an influence, particularly Berlin's writings on value pluralism and this idea that there's always going to be a conflict of values and a conflict over the interpretation of values, kind of rejection of moral absolutism.
And was she an academic?
Isaiah Berlin.
Yes.
Oh, you know, he's a philosopher. Oh, yeah. Yeah, famous Oxford Don, I think. Yeah, and so Owen kind of, he clings to this, or he kind of constructs this morality of compromise as kind of on the spot sort of philosophical cladding that will hopefully, you know, protect him from charges of hypocrisy and double standards. You know, he says that morality, far from being, or compromise rather, far from being the enemy of morality, is its friend when you accept this idea that there's always going to be a conflict of values. And I think it just kind of, again, reflects back on this sort of failure to effectively institutionalize human rights concerns.
Yeah.
This idea of establishing, you know, objective and reliable criteria is always a bit of a fallacy.
Mm-hmm.
It was supposed to kind of, protect ministers and from these kind of charges. But as you can clearly see, that it doesn't. And Owen, as a result, has to sort of construct this ad hoc, you know, philosophical protection when he's kind of being barraged by all these criticisms of double standards.
I think that's really interesting. Well, also looking at how it's done now, where it seems like the UK is still a bit more flexible when it comes to the morality of decisions, where the US, for example, have very strict legal laws, for example, which say if the groups that you're supporting or if the people you're working with transgress human rights, then you have to stop immediately. Mm-hmm. Whereas here it's more of a consideration of and more flexible in terms of the benefits of staying close so you can continue to influence. It's interesting to hear like the historical roots of that, I guess.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it's also important to say that, you know, you talked about Jimmy Carter earlier, and I'm not an expert on Jimmy Carter's administration by any means, but that he also faced some of these complications, you know, the balancing between national security interests and a human rights agenda. Mm. And I think there's that problem if you paint yourself as whiter than white, that you're inviting criticism as soon as you do something that even appears to contradict. Yeah. And that example of Robin Cook is one. Now, I did want to quickly, really briefly, look at what happened in the 80s under the Conservatives.
Yeah.
Did this all go out the window? What happened?
Yeah, so I mean, it's there's certainly things that you can point to that would indicate, you know, a kind of rapid sort of downgrading of this relationship between human rights and British foreign policy. So the human rights comparative assessment that we mentioned is very quickly decommissioned. We also mentioned the relationship between human rights and aid policy. Again, that connection is rapidly downgraded.
Which is very relevant today.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and but I think it would be. Yeah, it would be unfair to say that human rights kind of drops entirely off the radar. It's important to note that Thatcher and high-profile members of the Conservative administration were beholden to a very different conception of human rights than the Callaghan government that preceded it. So whereas high-profile members of the Callaghan government, including Owen, saw human rights as indivisible, so encompassing both socioeconomic rights and civil and political liberties. The Thatcher government privileged civil and political liberties and kind of weaponized this in a Cold War context.
Mm, right.
But you could also mention that this weaponization and a focus on engaging with human rights through the prism of the Helsinki process kind of helped to keep human rights at least on the British diplomatic radar, even if it was kind of separated from its socioeconomic applications. You saw during the late 1970s, you have a lot more engagement with debates surrounding the developing world and the kind of North-South dialogue, which very much kind of take more of a backseat during the 1980s.
This is all fascinating stuff, and I wish we had more time, but unfortunately we are coming towards the end. But I want to ask you one final question. So if you were to look at all this and kind of bring it to the modern day, what would your advice be to the modern government in regards to embedding a more human rights approach into their foreign policy?
Yeah, well, I mean, as not being a kind of international relations scholar myself, I think policy prescriptions are a bit above my pay grade, but yeah, I mean, certainly I think the positive steps have been taken to more effectively institutionalize human rights concerns. And in the report you mentioned, if, you know, well implemented, could be another step in that process. But I think you're always going to have what Jonathan Gilmore refers to as this uncertain merger of values and interests in foreign policy. And I honestly don't know if that can ever be sort of overcome. Perhaps maybe moves to, I don't know, democratize the foreign policy making process or make it more open would, you know, have the effect of kind of, you know, bringing a wider sort of section of society on board with this idea of compromise and sort of defining where those lines need to be drawn. I think going back to what we kind of started out by discussing, this idea of defining a nation's values and then projecting it onto the onto the global stage. That kind of process of definition is sort of done behind closed doors by a handful of ministers and foreign office officials. And then when those values bump up against economic interests, I think the assumption is that most people are fine with the kind of the compromise that ensues. Whereas I think, I don't know, maybe if, maybe more people would be okay with the idea of a financial setback if it meant that the government didn't have so much blood on its hands when it comes to dealing with these, you know, gross offenders of human rights. So yeah, I don't know, perhaps, but that's a very much.
I mean, and that was always a challenge for the Labour Party because obviously many of their constituencies had sort of quite strong industrial base that were providing manufacturing arms, and they I think they also struggled to balance that with their ethical foreign policy drive.
Well, that's it. Well, thank you very much. Yes. It's been incredibly interesting.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Take care.
Well, thank you very much for tuning in to that interview with David Greely. I hope you enjoyed it as much as we did. Now, for any of you who want to read a little bit more in depth about the topics we covered, we always put links to any research or publications that we have mentioned in the episode notes. And if you want to stay up to date with the Remote Warfare Programme or any other programme at the Oxford Research Group, then please subscribe to our newsletter by clicking on the button at the top of the page. You can also follow us on Twitter. Our handles are at ORGinfo, at remote_warfare. And if you are feeling a little bit isolated at the moment with everything that's going on in the world, well, we have a whole catalogue of previous episodes of our podcast, which are absolutely free to access. And if you want to do so, you could follow the link at the top of the page. We do hope that you'll join us very soon. Goodbye.